and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Abram Hoffer, who, from what I understand, is basically the father of orthomolecular medicine. How are you, Dr. Hoffer?
I'm fine.
Thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. So before we get started, if you don't mind, if you'll take just a minute or two, because I have a million questions for you, and tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came to do what you do.
Well, what I do, I am a consultant in orthomolecular medicine. But that doesn't tell you much. I'll give you my background. I am a psychiatrist. I became director of psychiatric research for the province of Saskatchewan in Canada in 1950. And at that time, we had a major problem. We still do. We had three large mental hospitals. We had many thousand schizophrenic patients for whom we had no treatment. And so I was given the job as director of research to try and develop some information about this condition and how to treat it more effectively. And in 1955, when the university medical school was completed, I was made a professor of psychiatry at the university. And I was professor of psychiatry until 1967, at which time I surrendered both my jobs and went into private practice. First of all, in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and then in 1976, I moved to Victoria, where I have been practicing ever since. But I you can gather, I've been at this game for a long time, and now I'm just about going to be 91 and a half. So three years ago, I got fed up with all the arguments we had to take part in, and so I surrendered my license. I gave up practicing medicine, and I became a consultant. And the interesting thing is that I more or less see the same kind of clients. I'm getting even better results when I am not practicing medicine as I did when I was practicing medicine.
You did. David Hawkins is one of my favorite people, by
who?
The way.
Oh, okay.
David Hawkins. You did a lot of work with him, too, didn't you?
Oh, and David and Hawkins and I were very close friends.
He's one of my... I'd like to say he's my mentor, though he may not know it.
Well, he's a great guy. And he was the one who, with Linus Pauling, published our book, which I think is going to remain a classic forever, called Orthomolecular Psychiatry. Have you seen the book?
No, I've not seen that, but I've read every other thing that he did.
You better
see over
it.
Your website.
It's a very valuable book, going up in price all the time. And it was an interesting book that contained some of the very, very basic information, which is really transforming medicine.
Give us your website, because I've gone over that with a fine-tooth comb, and it's really a good site for information on orthomolecular medicine.
Well, I really don't have it memorized. I never even looked at it myself.
Well, I'll tell my listeners, if you Google Abram Hoffer, you'll find it.
If you look up A. Hoffer on Google, you'll find 150,000 hits.
Yes, you will. So, for my listeners,
well,
tell them what orthomolecular...
There's a new book, I think, two new books I think you should read. One's called Orthomolecular Medicine for Everyone. It's a marvelous textbook. It was a book which I had written 15, 20 years ago, which is totally out of date. And with Dr. Andy Saul, he and I did the work, and now it's a beautiful book. Which has also become almost a bestseller at Amazon. I think it's a marvelous book because any physician who wishes to follow the treatment program can do so without any difficulty just by reading that book.
Is it Fire Your Doctor?
It's written by me and by Dr. Saul.
I have that book, and it's fabulous.
Yeah.
It really is.
The second book that just came off Trafford Press. And it's about a 130-page book. And in there, I analyze psychiatry as we knew it in 1950 and psychiatry as we knew it in 2007. And it is my unhappy conclusion that we did a better job treating psychiatric patients in 19, 50 than we do today. Now, I think it's not just my evidence. The evidence is there from the literature. All you have to do is look at it and pull it out properly. There's nothing that says in favor. There's nothing that says that psychiatry is any better. And it's an awful lot that says how much worse it is.
Well, I have to tell you something. You don't know me very well, but I have a very profound problem with depression for the last decade.
Uh-huh.
And I was on Effexor, 150 milligrams of Effexor and 150 milligrams of Wellbutrin.
Yes, yeah.
I went off of it completely and started doing what you said to do on your website.
Uh-huh.
And that was probably 4 months ago, and I'm on nothing now
that
but your stuff.
Help.
And I'm not depressed. And I don't fight it.
Well, you know, nature never meant people to become to suffer deficiency of these drugs. You know what these drugs are?
Bad for you.
they are poison. You know what a poison is?
Yes, I do.
When you buy a bottle of poison in a drugstore, they have to have a label on it, don't they?
Yes.
It says poison, skull bone, cross skull bone. Every bottle of medicine should have the same label on it, because everything that we sell to patients, which is supposed to be therapeutic, is poisonous. It comes from the weak word pharmakos, with a K, pharmakos with a K. And by definition, the pharmakos is a compound which has some value, but which is also poisonous. So all of modern medicine is based upon pharmakos. It's based upon toxic drugs, and that's why it's so difficult to get vitamins into the field of medicine, because they're not dangerous enough.
Yeah, they don't make money like they do off of the drug, dangers.
They make a lot of money for people who take them and get well.
Right.
But they don't make any money for the people who sell them.
Right.
With one exception, the big drug companies who also make the vitamins. I believe there was a statement some years ago that one of the big major drug companies was a major supplier of vitamin C. They made 25% of their worldwide drug profits just from selling vitamin C.
But
they would like to see the huge, huge profits that you can get by taking a simple poison,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't do any good, and yet you can persuade people to use it if you pay enough money for advertising.
I hear it over and over again when I talk to people about depression and pharmaceuticals. Well, I have a chemical imbalance, so I need this drug.
Well, you know, Eva, you're going to have to do something about that.
It drives me crazy.
Yeah, you're going to have to publicize what you're telling me. You're going to have to help educate the public that there are better ways of staying well and getting well than it is to depend upon these terrible poisons.
Well, that's exactly why I do this radio show.
Well, that's
so
good.
Let me ask you this, because I have a long list of questions for you. Before we get started, what is orthomolecular medicine?
Well, it was Linus Pauling's definition. and he was he was one of the most brilliant Americans that ever lived. And he became interested in sickle cell anemia. He discovered the cause of sickle cell anemia. And at that time, he began thinking about what he called molecular medicine. Molecular, in other words, he was the chemist who had discovered how molecules interact with each other. And this is the whole basis of modern medicine. If Linus Pauling hadn't lived, we'd have a different type of modern medicine than we have already. So he was already thinking about the interaction of molecules with each other. And then he heard about our work. And we became close friends. And it was about this time at one of our meetings in Vancouver, where I was chair. I was usually chair of all these meetings that we had. And David Hawkins was at the meeting with me. And I was sitting at the head of the table, and David was sitting to my right. And we went around the table. There were about 15 or 20 of us, doctors from the United States and Canada. We went around the table telling each other what we were doing and the kind of results we were seeing. And as we were talking, it occurred to me, here's this fantastic amount of information going around to this very small group of people. No one even hears about it. And suddenly, without thinking, and this happens to me often maybe, without thinking, I said to the group, and explained why, we are going to have to publish a book. So they looked up at me in surprise. They had gotten used to the thing to the fact that I get some pretty dumb ideas quite often. And so so they said, well, who will we get to write it? So without thinking, I said, well, we'll ask David Hawkins to author it. And David said, what? And gulped. And I said, we'll help you, David. Every one of us will contribute a chapter and we'll help. And we'll leave it on Vaitlana's calling to see if he will also make a contribution. And so David Hawkins agreed. I think with great reluctance he agreed. And then we approached Linus Pauling, and then he agreed with a very stiff condition. He's an honest, but a very ethical type of guy. He said, yes, I'll take part. And we wanted him to be a co-editor. He said, yes, I'll take part if I have full power to veto. If I don't like the paper, it doesn't go in. We, of course, were delighted with that. That couldn't have been a better condition. So we set the book up. So then we got to work on his book. So poor David, he must have had the busiest year of his life following that incident. And so he published the book, Ultima Lectures. So Linus defined it now as Ultima Lectures disease is one which is caused by a lack of or a deficiency of the natural nutrients which are present in the body, like the amino acids, like the vitamins, like some of the minerals, like some of the hormones. For example, doctors don't know that, but diabetes would be called the North Molecular Disease. Because
I think probably most diseases
not
are
insulin.
At their base, don't you think?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
So it means that when you're treating with orthomolecular, we depend to a large degree on the use of these natural components. That does not mean, very important, that does not mean that we do not use drugs. We do use drugs, but usually we use them very carefully in small amounts. And the drugs are secondary. They are not primary. Modern psychiatry, the primary treatment is a drug. You call the patient and give them a drug. Say, here, my good guy. Here, take this drug. You'll be okay. But the problem is they never get okay, and they never can stop taking their drugs. We do use drugs, but we use them like a crutch. If you crack your leg and you have to walk with a crutch, well, that's fine. You have to do it. But as soon as the leg is healed, you throw the crutch away. With modern psychiatry, you never throw the crutch away. You never throw the drug away because the drug in itself makes you sick.
Right.
So that's one of the major, major disadvantages. And the result is that I think modern psychiatry is corrupt in the United States. If you heard President Obama speaking on the crisis, you'll be amazed at what he says. He, in fact, is coming right out and blamed modern medicine for a big part of the scam that's been going on.
I can't agree more. I study it all the time.
Yeah. I've been practicing 1950, and I can say the results are fantastic. We see the results of cancer, multiple sclerosis, diabetes, schizophrenia, schizoaffective, manic depressive. There isn't a single disease that could not be helped by. Except, of course, if you have to have surgery, you're not going to replace surgery with medication. So
right.
we have two types of wounded people. We have those who are called the walking wounded, like people with arthritis, and they are the ones for whom there is no treatment except orthomolecular. I mean, there is no treatment that's any good. And then we have those who are really wounded. For example, if you're in a car accident and wind up in an emergency unit, modern medicine is pretty good for that.
Yeah.
You wouldn't start giving people vitamins if he's bleeding to death in the operating room.
I would like to cover, there are three things I want to make sure we cover. And I've got a bunch of questions. Depression, bipolar, schizophrenia.
Okay.
Then I want to cover heart disease.
Okay.
And I want to cover diabetes and endocrine.
You'll have to take charge.
Okay. My first question is,
also, can you speak up a bit? I can hardly hear.
Okay. My first question is, I know that you treat the profound depression and schizophrenia with niacin.
That's one of the things.
Large doses of niacin, right?
Yeah.
Now, the question that I have here is, when I have found personally that when I started taking this niacin, and other people, too, I've read about, get edema around the ankles. What is that telling us?
What you are asking is, why do some people who take niacin develop edema around the ankles?
Yes.
Well, unless they're having problems with their circulatory system anyway, I don't understand why they would.
So what does that mean? Is it telling us we have a circulatory problem? And how would we...
It means that you have to make sure that your heart's working properly.
Okay.
But also, it could mean that they started taking too much niacin at first, because it does release histamine. Often when you release too much histamine, you do get some edema.
Okay.
Usually when that happens, you start more slowly. Instead of starting up with the full dose, you start out, say, with a quarter dose or half a dose.
And what is the benefit of having such a histamine release?
There isn't any.
So it doesn't, that doesn't have histamine?
The benefit comes from niacin because, you know, everyone's making a big to-do about cholesterol levels.
Uh-huh.
Did you know that there isn't a compound better in the whole world than niacin for making normal cholesterol levels?
The drug company was spending billions
selling statins, which really had no value.
So does the histamine, does the niacin also help with hypercholesterolemia?
Yes.
What?
If that's really what it does.
Okay.
The only cholesterol values that are significantly important are the high-density cholesterol. If your total blood cholesterol is high, that's not a big problem. But if your total, if your H, the heavy one, the high density cholesterol is too low, that's a problem. Now we discovered, my friends and I, my colleagues and I, in 1954, we discovered that niacin lowered total cholesterol, it elevated the HDL, it lowered some of the other bad factors in bloodstream, and in fact there was a study done by the American government called the National Coronary Drug Study 15-25 years ago, where they proved that men who had had one coronary and who took proper amounts of niacin thereafter, there was a decrease of 10% in their death and their death rate and a 2-year increase in life extension. It's the only compound, in spite of all the advertising you've heard about statin, niacin is the only compound which has been proven to help people's cardiovascular levels better in both men and women.
Now, is there a target dose I know that some people go up, you know, 10, 20,000, but where do you look to?
The amount of niacin I want to eat is usually just 3 grams a day.
3 grams a day, okay.
Yeah.
And you break that down in even doses?
It's available in 500 milligram tablets, and you start off normally with a pill 3 times a day, and then it may go up to the full dose, which is 1 gram 3 times per day.
Okay.
You can also buy, and you can buy this slow release niacin in the States, and that's a bit of a gimmick too, because you can buy a standard niacin that will do all these good things for $10 a month. But if you want to get rid of the flush, the problem with niacin is that you have to learn how to take the flush when you first start. But if you buy the flush preparation, the non-flush preparation, the same vitamins will cost $200 a month.
Wow. And so I know that the heart, when people who have heart disease, a lot of people have a lot of mast cells in their heart with, you know, filled with histamine. So is that not indicative if you have a lot of histamine that needs to be released? Is it not telling you
something? Well, there's some people that might have too much histamine. Histamine, by the way, is a very important factor. It's a neurotransmitter. No one really knows what role it plays and why there's some of it, especially in the gut. The major source of histamine in the body are in the gut and in the brain. And they are important, and there's no question that niacin plays a role. By the way, niacin has become fashionable. It's become very fashionable. Did you know that Suzanne Summers, you've heard of Suzanne?
Yeah, I've heard of her.
She spoke in Montreal a few days ago to a large crowd of people, and she, in fact, now is now agitating and suggesting that people follow orthomolecular medicine.
Another question I have. If you take these non-flushing forms of niacin or niacinamide,
you sometimes have to take them away and they don't work as good. Because many people just don't want to go through the flushing sequence. But they don't work as well, and they usually cost a lot more.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. All right. And what about hypercholesterolemia? You're one of the few people that ever writes anything about that.
Well,
what can you tell us about that?
I think that when you take niacin, you don't have to worry about it.
Okay.
Because it's going to be normal anyway. Ideally, I wouldn't do that. If a patient came to me, the first thing I would do is cut out all their sugar. Because I think the major villain when it comes to cholesterol is sugar. So I would bring the sugar down to very low levels if I could. That's the main thing I would do. I would also decrease the carbohydrates, but I would not. I would not decrease fat, and I would not decrease protein. In other words, I wouldn't object to the steak for breakfast if people wanted to eat that. But I would use niacin because it has so many other factors. My friend, Professor Harold Foster from the University of Victoria, we wrote a book on niacin called The Feel Better, Live Longer with B3, a very popular 112 book just describing the virtues of niacin. You wouldn't believe what it can do. It can help people with MS get well. It's good for depression. It's great for anxiety. Best of all, it works for schizophrenics, but you have to know how to use it, of course. And I suggest that people read my books before they declare themselves to be experts.
So let's talk a minute about depression, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia. I know it really works, but I'm just going to say to you, does it really work? And what do you do, and what kind of results do you see, and how quickly do you see them?
Well, talking about schizophrenia can be difficult because it depends when you get them. They might have been sick 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. If they have been sick for 20 years, living in a mental hospital, they're going to be damaged by the amount of drugs they've already taken. They're going to be damaged by the fact they have been hidden away from society. They have been almost ruined. We are building up a huge population of chronic patients whose life depends upon medication because they are very strongly addictive. Modern drugs are very, very dangerous, very addictive. They really are, no question about that. But let's assume that I can see the patients for the first, having had their first attack, say, within the first 2 years. If they will come to me, and if they will follow the program for at least 2 years, I would expect that 80 to 90% would be normal.
Now,
by normal, let me tell you what I mean. I mean, they are free of signs and symptoms. An example would be a very talented young artist that I saw from Las Vegas, singer, dancer, etc. He was so sick he couldn't function. We can't hear him. Within 2 years, he was back on stage again. Free of signs and symptoms. The second item is they're getting along well with their family. That's important. You don't find many of our orthomolecular patients shooting their school teachers or screwing their school children. Most of these serial elders and murderers are probably schizophrenic, and many of them are being treated with drugs.
What about bipolar?
They get along well with the community. And fourthly, and this is extremely important, they pay income tax.
The what? Oh, they pay income tax. What about bipolar disorders?
Now, bipolar, this is now becomes much more complicated. And the way I see it, and you have to remember that I'm not very popular when it comes to modern psychiatry. And the reason is that I have a very low opinion of modern psychiatry. A very low opinion. And I am doing something that was done many years ago. You had in the States a very famous psychiatrist called Dr. Nolan D.C. Lewis, who was the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University in New York. He's a very good friend of mine, Dr. Lewis. And he did a study that I doubt any American has ever remembered. He took 70 patients who all were diagnosed. They were then called manic depressive. And there were 70 of them called manic depressive on admission to their hospital, and he calls them up to see what happened with them in time. And he discovered, I think, to his surprise, that after 10 to 15 years, one half of the 70 patients that had been diagnosed as manic depressive were now diagnosed schizophrenia.
Really?
So he went back again over the original data to ask himself, what had changed? Had it been a mistake in the diagnosis, or had the disease really changed its stripes? They concluded that the disease had not changed its stripes, but in fact that the diagnosis had been missed. And then he pointed out that if these people had taken into account the hallucinations that these patients have, they would have picked up almost every one of them accurately. So it is hard to diagnose, to make a distinction between the schizophrenic, the schizoaffective, which is the halfway group, and between, and also the pure bipolar. My own definition is quite simple. If they have a lot of mood swings, and during their manic state, if they're high, they are hallucinated. If they are hallucinated all the time, they're probably schizophrenic. If they're hallucinated only when they're high, they are schizophrenic affective. And if they are never hallucinogenic, then they're clearly bipolar. They respond pretty well to different types of programs. I don't want to leave the idea that all you have to do is throw vitamins at them. It's a lot more complicated than that. But there is a particular program for each condition, and one has to vary the amount of vitamins which are used if one wants to get the right results.
Do you have to take your other vitamin, B vitamins, along with the niacin to make
that's
it
a very,
work right?
That's a very important question. A very important question. Because many of my colleagues who are really interested in what I am doing, they have ignored very obvious fact. They have ignored the fact that in all our work, we never claimed that schizophrenia was a vitamin deficiency. We claimed it was caused by a niacin deficiency. And what bothers me is I find so many people who go to various clinics around the country to get treated by orthomolecular methods, and all they give them is a bunch of and all they do is give them a bunch of vitamins, and they do not follow the injunction. It's got to be niacin. I've seen so many patients who are given 20 different vitamins and don't respond one bit because they're not getting enough
B3.
Mm-hmm. So schizophrenia is very important to understand that schizophrenia is not the deficiency of all the vitamins. It's a deficiency of B3.
And I have somebody listening tonight that has the kind of bipolar problem where they don't hallucinate. They just get deep, dark depression or the manic high and aggressive violence.
Well, now we're talking about niacin may or may not be the answer, but there are answers. And the full dose answer is that you have to find out why they are depressed. You know, in psychiatry, they pay too much attention to names, calling people things.
Mm-hmm.
You diagnose this, you diagnose that, it doesn't matter what you diagnose them, they all get the same drug. What's important is not what you call them. What's important is how do you get them well.
Right.
In other words, you have to know why they are sick. And we now know, and we've written about this in our book, that nutrition is extremely important. You'd be amazed how many people are very sick from depression simply because they are eating foods to which they are allergic.
Yes.
So we have to dig into their diet, find out are they allergic to milk, dairy products, are they allergic to eggs. I would guess that 75% of all the patients that I see have one or more major food allergies. And take it from me, they are not going to get rid of their depression until they also get rid of these foods. And many other things they have to do. Many of them have to take probiotics.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they have to take probiotics in order to clean out their pathological bacteria and to allow the good ones to come back. So nutrition is extremely important. Secondly,
right.
You want to have to go after the right vitamin. It might be a deficiency of C or B6, or folic mm-hmm. acid, or B12. It can be anything. And it can be not only a deficiency, it can also be a dependency. It can be due to excess use of alcohol, excess use of sugar. There are, I would say, at least 12 different reasons why people can become depressed, which is all related somehow to their nutrition. And until these are discovered and worked out, they're not going to get anywhere. So just as simply to find someone who is depressed and give them lots of niacin will certainly help some. But it's not going to help them all.
All right. Now I want to talk about, you touched on sugar a minute ago, so I want to talk about, I have some questions about that, and I have some questions about minerals. And then I want to move on to amino acids. My question about sugar is, I know that a lot of people that have depression also have hypoglycemia.
Yeah.
And
well, they go together.
Yeah, they do, don't they?
Yeah.
And I want to talk about polyphenol, chromium, vanadium. Do you think that...
Well, that's why and treatment has to be individualized. And that's why it's important for the patient to go to a doctor who really knows what he's doing in order to give that patient exactly what is needed. There's no point just giving him 50 different things, just hoping that you're going to give him one that's going to be correct, which is what happens too much today.
Yeah, well, there's not enough Abram Hoffers. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have enough of you.
There will be more.
I hope so.
Especially if you do your job properly.
So let's talk about minerals. Magnesium, zinc, selenium, copper.
Minerals don't play such a great role except for zinc.
What about magnesium?
Magnesium, and, well, they're all important. It's hard to say which is most important. It's the most important to have the right ratio of calcium to magnesium. It's the most important to have the right ratio of copper to zinc. This is all described in that book that I mentioned at the beginning of this interview. And minerals are extremely important. I had a young woman of 80, and she was literally starving to death. Her sense of taste had gone totally flat. Couldn't taste a thing. Food tasted absolutely awful. So she was gradually eating less and less. And she came to see me. Now, I suspected right away that she was deficient in zinc, because one of the main symptoms of a zinc deficiency is, in fact, that you do lose your sense of taste and smell. And so I put her on my program, and it's a lot, what I thought was a lot of zinc. And she kept coming back to see me for 2 years and wasn't getting anywhere. So one day I was getting kind of fed up with her and with me, because, you know, a doctor doesn't like to see a patient ever gets well.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, Mrs. So-and-so, I said, I don't understand. Why do you keep coming to see me? I'm not healthy. So she said, Dr. Hoffer, she said, at least you're trying. So I saw the courage in her eyes, so I said, okay, I think I better try harder. So I changed my tactics. Instead of giving her a tablet of zinc, I started giving her the liquid. And the most amazing thing, within 6 months, she was enjoying her food, and 5 or 10 years later, she came bouncing into my office to tell me how well she was.
I think that that's an important thing, because you don't absorb all those supplements.
You have to absorb it, and she wasn't. And that's one another factor that makes it complicated, because many allergic foods, for example, milk. If you drink milk, you don't absorb your minerals very well. It talks about milk being high in calcium. Well, it may well be, but it certainly doesn't get through very often. And if you give a person zinc with a glass of milk, it'll go right through them. They don't absorb it. So again, with the minerals, you have to be careful. Now, in most cases, you don't have to look upon each patient as a lifetime research subject. I often get very frustrated that the number of lab tests which are ordered for these people, which are totally unnecessary and which have never been shown to play any role. I think the important thing is to use good medical common sense. And if they are not reporting to the program that you have them on, say to yourself, what am I doing wrong? Maybe I should change it.
Andrew Saul said something the other day, abnormal mineral metabolism, but he couldn't elaborate more, and he said, you know, that's a question for Abram. What is that, and what do you do for it?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Abnormal mineral metabolism.
Well, I think that's pretty rare. I think that's extremely rare. It's something that the average doctor is not going to see very often. But most of the time, you may see a problem with calcium or magnesium, so I usually give them some, just as a precaution, especially women who don't like to get a crick in their neck. And even men will get that. The only ones I'm usually really worried about are zinc and copper, especially around here where I live in Victoria. The problem is often too much copper because of the acid water coming down from Japan,
mm-hmm.
and because of the copper plumbing that we all have. But we do have to take that into account. And usually, if a patient has been working with you long enough and they are not responding to the treatment you have followed, then it might be a good idea to do a proper analysis of hair. Hair analysis can be helpful.
What is a symptom of copper deficiency?
Usually there are hematological, they have trouble making blood.
Okay. They also
become hyperoxidized.
That's interesting. What about, I know a lot of people who have something called, including myself, magnesium wasting. I can't keep it. So I started using magnesium chloride lotion that Norm Shealy told me about. I had high blood pressure, Abram, and it dropped 70 points in 3 weeks when I started doing that transdermal magnesium.
Yeah, that's right.
So can you tell us why that happened? Why can't somebody hold on to magnesium?
I have no idea.
Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about amino acids then.
Well, amino acids are a lot less, in my opinion. The use of amino acids has been greatly exaggerated. And I find that in North America, I would find that the most common source of amino acid deficiency would be in places like Africa and Asia. Because usually whenever you have malnutrition, that's when you are going to have a deficiency of protein. But I have found that to be much, much of a problem. And I really don't worry about amino acids here. So I don't use them specifically. I know that some doctors are using amino acids for depression, and I think they can be helpful. But I don't pay much attention to them. I think that what we should concentrate on are the people we can help, the ones who are most likely to be sick, and then to move on further from there.
Well, what about people who have heart and vessel diseases, you know, where the heart muscle is not strong enough and their vessels aren't, they're not strong enough. What do you do for that?
Well, if they don't respond to things like vitamin C, it just strengthens the collagen.
And how much vitamin C are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about at least 2 grams a day.
Okay.
And they also should be taking lysine, L-lysine.
And how much are you talking about there?
I'm talking about anywhere from 1 gram per day to more.
Okay.
But again, these are rare.
What about arginine?
Margarine?
Arginine and lysine.
I don't use that. The reason is that I'm trying to use a program which is very economical for the patient. I don't like patients to have to put out $100 a month for the rest of their year of their life when they don't have to do that. And I have found that all these nuanced programs, all these new programs that one reads about, I haven't had to use them, and if I don't need to use them, why are they needed?
Okay.
Because I have seen probably over 10,000 schizophrenic patients since 1955.
Well, when you're talking about lysine for the heart and vessel, what does lysine do for the heart and vessel?
It strengthens the walls of the capillaries.
Okay.
And the arteries.
Okay. Let's see. What about iodine and fatigue and thyroid.
Would you hang on for a minute? Or something?
Sure.
Hang on.
Give us just a minute, folks. I'm sure Dr. Hoff will be right back.
Sorry.
That's all right. So back to the iodine and fatigue and thyroid issues. You know, so many people go to the doctor and the doctor would do the thyroid test and say, your thyroid's fine. But I don't think they do the right test to really figure that out. Are you there?
There is a big debate about that. There's a big debate on the fact that there's a small school of medicine breaking off, where they maintain that the TSH test by itself doesn't tell us anything. And that if one wants to find out what's wrong with the thyroid, one has to do further testing. One will have to do T3 and T4, and you might even have to do a therapeutic trial with the natural, with the whole thyroid, desiccated thyroid, rather than just using the synthetic. So there's a great big question about that. I tend to think that the laboratory tests are overly exaggerated, and I would prefer to depend upon the original values like T3 and T4. But these are totally out of fashion. And doctors have lost their license to practice medicine because they had the temerity to think maybe there's another way of doing things.
So let's talk about lab testing for just a minute, across the board. If someone, when it comes to minerals and serotonin and your sugar levels and things, if the lab test is a little bit above normal,
okay,
does that still mean it's okay, or is it telling you something?
It means something.
Should you start looking
though? You have to understand mathematics. You have to understand chemistry. There's always a range of variation. If the normal value, say, should be between 10 and 20, and the reading is 9, many doctors go into a panic, which is totally ridiculous. They should say, this is totally normal. In fact, I tend to play down laboratory tests unless they are really, really out of line. They have to be totally out of line. So I think there's a fantastic amount of money wasted. If President Obama wanted to save billions of dollars, he would simply wipe out all the laboratory tests in the United States.
Well, I have another question for you here. Are you familiar with Doc? And I didn't ask Andrew this, but since you work with David Hawkins, are you familiar with all of his work on consciousness?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, do you think that the same laboratories test values is the same for everyone? I mean, everyone's body's different.
Well, theoretically, it's supposed to be. But unless the test has been validated, it's what we call validation. If you have 10 different laboratories, you send them all exactly the same sample of hair, and they all come back and give you exactly the same values, then you've got a very good test, haven't
mm-hmm.
you?
Yeah.
But you can bet on it, it won't happen. You'll find a fantastic variation. So the only way one can be reasonably sure of a test is to repeat that same test over and over and over and over. And that can become terribly expensive and totally wasteful.
Okay. Let's talk a minute about vitamin C, because I know that's one of your passions.
Yeah. I think it's a great question.
Talk about it.
Pardon?
Just tell me about it. Tell me where your heart lies there, what's most important about it, and what will it do, and how much should we take? And
well, I'll tell you, I can't tell you about vitamin C because it's too much to talk about. In the past 6 years alone, there have been 4 or 5 excellent books published. Total hardcover books have been published on the enormous value of vitamin C. There's just no way one can minimize its relative importance.
But it has to be in large doses, right?
No, no.
200 milligrams
is
not going to do anything, though, is it?
No, it doesn't have to be. There is a natural variation. If you're looking at humanity, if you're looking at, say, the height of adult males,
mm-hmm.
it's what we call a bell-shaped curve. You know about that one.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bell-shaped curve that you can characterize by saying that the values have to be plus or minus 2 standard deviations from the mean. In other words, we're going to have some guys at 3.5, and we're going to have a very few who are 7.5. But there's a natural variation in this test, and this applies to almost anything we're dealing with. So one has to find out what is the natural distribution, and then whether the lab tests are showing that there's any maldistribution. Are some people having too much, or are some people having too little? And even that by itself is not enough because you also have to think. you know, one of the biggest problems, one of the biggest problems in medicine is thinking. Did you know that?
I think it's a problem across the board.
I don't mean much by the patient's thinking. It's by doctor's thinking. And so I think that we ask that, first of all, common sense doctors who can think. Let me give you an example. When I was interning in 1949, there was an 80-year-old woman who was dying from some type of cancer. I don't remember what. And she was suffering from severe pain. And I just started out as an intern, so I went to her GP, who was in charge, and I said, why don't you give her some morphine for her pain? He said, I can't do that. And I said, why not? He said, she might become addicted. So he's prepared to let her suffer the last week or two or month of her life just because he's afraid of the word addiction. I mean, where's the common sense in that?
If you're trying to cure a cancer,
yes.
Well, is 200 milligrams of vitamin C going to help you, or do you have to move on up to several thousand?
Well, if vitamin C in cancer was a, you might have to go to higher. I have seen since 1955. Since 1967, I've seen 1,500 cases of cancer, and you'd be amazed at how many of them have made complete recoveries just by using vitamin C and also vitamin B3.
That's my next.
I've written several books about that. You probably have seen them.
So what? And you're talking about D as in David 3.
Yeah. I start with 12.
So what kind of dose of vitamin C do you take? Most people take a pill a day that's like 500 milligrams.
No,
is that going to cure
if
cancer?
If they're starting off with cancer, I usually have them take the powder and they dissolve. They dissolve 12 grams.
Mm-hmm.
12 grams of ascorbic acid, that's vitamin C powder.
That's 12,000 milligrams, right?
Right on.
People don't.
And I have them dissolve that in 12 ounces of juice, 12 ounces of juice. And now they take, they keep that in the fridge, and then they take during the day, they drink 2 ounces of that vitamin C mixture 6 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they are drinking 2 grams of vitamin C into their body 6 times a day. And the reason for that is that vitamin C is very rapidly gotten rid of, excreted. And if you give them a vitamin C shot in the morning and nothing the rest of the day, but by mid-afternoon, they don't have any anyway. So you have to put it in there regularly. Now, once they show me that they can tolerate this quantity, then I gradually have them increase it until they reach what we call a laxative level.
Mm-hmm.
And they go so high that until it acts like a laxative, and then they have to cut their dose down. One of the men that came to me 20 years ago had a terrible lymphoma. He'd had surgery, radiation. Never responded to anything. I put him on my vitamin C program. That's 20 years ago. And he's still well today. So he was in about a couple of years ago just to shake hands and say hello.
And you mixed that with did you give him vitamin D3 too?
That's right.
What
and
kind
so
of dosage?
So I asked him. I said, hey, how much vitamin C did you take? He said, I took 40 grams. He took 40,000 milligrams of vitamin C each day. So I said, did you have diarrhea? He said, yes. So I said, what did you do? He said, I sat in a can and read all day.
How much D3? And what is the difference from D and D3?
D3 is niacin.
Oh, I thought you said D3, said B as in boy, right?
I'm sorry. Vitamin D is extremely important. Yeah, vitamin D is extremely important, especially with all this recent work as an anti-cancer. And I do give my patients a lot of vitamin D. Usually, I'm starting with 12,000 units a day.
Is it D or D3?
D, A, B, C, D.
Right, but is it...
Actually, it should be called D3.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, that's what I was trying to figure out. D is in David 3.
That's right.
Okay. Now, we've got about 5 minutes left. Is there anything you want to talk about that we haven't already talked about?
What I want to talk about is how will it be possible for you to persuade President Obama that the President of the Canadian and American psychiatric system is for the bird? And my opinion is that if we were to export every North American psychiatrist to Mars, he would be better off and we would be worse off. Sorry, he would be worse off and we would
right.
be better off.
I tell you, I don't have a big... My doctor, I'm 49, and 3 years ago when my blood pressure started creeping up, he said, Eva, you're getting old. So I have to give you these two blood pressure medicines. You know, if he had just told me to do minerals and niacin and D3 and C, which is what I do now, and I'm on no blood pressure medicines. Rarely do I take one.
That's good.
You know, I got well, but he didn't know that.
Well, I think the problem is that the universities, the medical schools won't teach this stuff. The medical journals won't publish it. Medline will not review it. There seems to be a conspiracy, using the word advisedly, there seems to be a conspiracy to prevent this information from getting out. I don't say there is a conspiracy. I think it's just that people think alike that they act alike. But I think that unless we get this information out, we're going to continue to have problems. People are going to lose their homes. People are going to go broke. People are going to die. 48 million people cannot get medical coverage in the States. That's a bloody shame that they can't do that, but maybe another way of looking at it is that if you can't get medical coverage, you won't get killed by modern medicine.
Let me see how much time we have. I want to ask you about one more thing. We got about 3 minutes left. Do you know anything about iridium and germanium?
I know nothing about... I know there are metals, but that's all I know.
Because that's the newest thing that's caught my attention, is the oxygen effects of germanium.
Well, I think that all these things are going to have to be looked at very, very carefully. But what I don't want to see is people jumping too soon. I don't want people to say, hey, that's a good idea, and within 2 years he says, I've got a new treatment. That's totally impossible. It's impossible to develop any new treatment in the field of medicine quite so quickly.
Yeah.
I think basically we no longer have, it is not a scientific issue. It is not a scientific issue. It is a political issue, political and economic issue.
I don't doubt that.
If I just finish on one thing that really bothers me. Do you know that in the States 1.5 million kids are now being treated for bipolar?
Yes, I do.
Using atypical drugs, which are very toxic. You knew that, did you?
Yes, I do. I mean, the school tried to put my children on them, and I started giving my children B3, niacin, and magnesium, and it helped him tremendously.
Well, it won't kill him either.
Yeah.
But at least did you know that, according to the New York Times, a front page released about 6 months ago, the three major doctors from Harvard who put the idea out that you could treat these kids were each given $1.5 million for the drug company.
Don't even get me started on that. It burns me.
Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Well, that's the sort of thing that...
burns me up, that's all I can say.
Yeah.
And it burns me up that the teachers in the school
try
to convince their parents to put their kids on these drugs.
Yeah.
So I started Xeroxing stuff and inundating my school
with
stuff about orthomolecular medicine. They finally left me alone.
I know.
They called in a psychologist trying to make me put my child on that drug, and I wouldn't do it.
So the important is that how can we break the barrier? Actually, how can we break the information barrier? The information is there. You have an idea how much information has been published. I've published 32 books all by myself, and there are hundreds of books available today. But none of it ever gets filtered into the medical schools.
I don't know what to say, except the people have to demand it.
Well, I don't know what to say either. That's our problem.
I really don't, but I thank you for coming on my show. I'm grateful for the work that you do.
You're very welcome.
And all I can say is I'm honored that you came to talk tonight.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hopper.
Thanks.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health. Integral Health. Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.